Welcome to the Athletic NBA Show,
Monday through Friday,
on the Athletic Podcast Network.
Coming up on today's show, we ponder if the stretch big is dead, and we feel the need for speed.
This is Nerdish, You Wrote, with your host, Dave Dufour.
With Mo DeKeel.
Are you ready to be entertained?
And Seth Partnow.
Hello and welcome to the Athletic NBA Show. It's Friday. That means it's Nerdish, She Wrote. I'm Dave. I got Seth and Mo here. We got a big show, so we want to jump right in. Fellas, it seems like this season is starting to get its legs under it in the last week since we recorded. I still have no idea what is happening, but we just had a week with no positive COVID tests. I think that's a really big deal.
Yeah, right.
Well, yeah. Well, I think it's worth bringing that up because, maybe we will start to get to a sense of normalcy, as normal as anything can be, but a sense of normalcy in the season now that it seems as if they're getting things under control. It seems like the enhanced protocols are working. Hopefully they're working. I mean, they at least had zero positive tests, so that's a good sign.
Yeah, the one thing, Seth, about the All-Star stuff, because I'm with you on we don't really need to be doing this, but at the same time too, I'm like, at least they're going to be in a controlled environment, whereas the other 2/3 of the league is going to be on vacation somewhere. Like, I don't trust these dudes. Yeah, plain and simple.
So I don't think we want to spend a ton of time on this, but it's sort of the individual risk versus the systemic risk. And the systemic risk of, and I think Hollinger wrote about this today, is you go to All-Star game, someone tests positive, all of a sudden the 30 best players in the league are on the shelf for 2 weeks.
Right.
That's what scares me. That's what I brought that up on Point of Contention last week. That's the thing that scares me more than anything. It's like, okay, yeah. I mean, it's going to come back to bite the league in the ass is really my stance.
Look, exhibition games are a luxury, even during normal circumstances. This is not normal.
I bet you guys are happy with the Elam ending coming back.
Sure. Yeah, it's great. But I'd rather see that in real games, not exhibition. Okay, so Seth, you asked Mo and I what I felt like was an odd question the other day. Now, you expanded on it, and so I understand exactly what you mean. But I want to go through the process that landed us here. You asked us if the stretch big is dead. And when you look around the league and you see that, I don't know, half the league is – got at least one stretch big. A lot of them have more than one. I'd argue that the stretch big exists, but has it been killed? Is the question, Seth?
I think that's a great way of putting it. It was the kind of thing that in sort of the strategic rock paper scissors that we tend to have in not just basketball and a lot of sports. When you were zigging and you had the stretch big and no one else did, it was great. Now that everyone is playing with a stretch big, it's not special, and teams have kind of figured out how to counter it. A quick stat on that front. The way NBA designates positions isn't perfect, but as recently as 2 years ago, around 14.5% of minutes went to guys the NBA was calling centers. This year, it's down to 12.9%. And that's both maybe the employing of more stretch bigs, but it also means there's less situations where a stretch big can get an advantage by, you know, oh, they've got this lumbering, you know, they've got Enes Kanter or Jonas Valanciunas or someone like that, that we're gonna drag out in the perimeter and make look silly. Well, that guy's just not on the floor as much anymore. And so that's a subtle change and makes me think that it's just strategically, have we moved past that?
Well, it's evolving. And you know, it's always been about skill. So I'd argue that the guys who can guard on the perimeter are the guys who are going to survive this next iteration of stretch big.
Well, it's interesting because I know what you're talking about, Seth, because everybody's just saying, you know, we're going to put our small forward on the big guy, right? Like you're seeing it in Dallas. I know Dave's watched a ton of Dallas doing the 77 Minutes in Heaven show. So, you know, they're always putting the smaller guy on him. And it comes down to this to me. If your stretch big can post up a little bit. And that's, you know, it's funny because the Mavs are posting up Porzingis a little bit more this year because they're putting a smaller guy. Let me finish. They're putting a smaller guy on him. And it's not even like a true post up, but mm-hmm. it's just a smaller guy where he just turns around and goes, I'm 7'3". Contest this, you know, and having success out of that. And I think it comes down to mm-hmm. that. And it's something like when you look at Milwaukee, they don't post up Brook Lopez that much, even when he has a smaller guy on him. And I think that's the counter. If you have a stretch big that can. Now, there are some stretch bigs that, good Lord, you do not want them to have the ball in the post. But, like, that's the counter to me. And that's how the stretch big, and it's really the stretch five at this point, survives in the league. And that's how that kind of moves, beats that we're going to put a small forward on you.
Well, look at the guys we consider the best bigs in the league, right? What are they able to do? Joel Embiid, he can stretch the floor, but he can post up. He can dominate mismatches. He's gotten so much better at handling the double. Like, that is, you know, the best version of a big in the league right now. It's that Joel Embiid, a true big. I mean, I think Giannis is likely a big, but, you know, we'll just say Embiid since he's a true center, I'll say. The ability to score multiple levels, to dominate a mismatch, and to be able to handle a double team. And between Embiid and Jokic, I think you see how valuable having a guy who's 7 feet who can do that can be to a team. But then you've got a lot of guys that are, you know, they're bits and pieces of that. Maybe they can post up a little bit. Maybe they can just shoot and can't post up. I mean, this is the thing with Porzingis. I'm not sure that there are enough guys in the league who can just score in all of the different ways you need to be able to score as a big to make it so that putting a wing on them defensively isn't the move.
Well, let me posit another way where you maybe don't have to have like the soccer player footwork of like an Embiid or a Jokic. It's our old friend Rudy Gobert. Okay, you don't want to throw him the ball in the post. But you put a 6'4" guy on him, what's he going to do? Get every offensive rebound.
Right.
So so that's another way to counter it. And again, you brought up the example of Brook Lopez. Milwaukee's spending more time just sticking him in the corner. And, you know, that's not a great spot to offensive. It's a part of why I don't really love bigs shooting corner threes is they get stuck in the corner waiting for the ball. And they're neither really in great position to set your defense or go for an offensive rebound. So, you know, if he's going to be a floor spacer to the corner, yeah, they play Charlotte this week and PJ Washington is guarding him and there's no stress on that matchup at all, even though PJ Washington's good and plays up well, but Brook Lopez has got to have 60 pounds and 5 inches on him and the skill to make use of that. So, kind of strategically figuring out how to not to take a mismatch from that and not give a mismatch. It seems like that's the crux of what we're seeing.
Yeah, and the thing I find it interesting about it is it's almost lazy coaching, you know, in the sense of like, okay, we got to stretch big, go stretch the floor, and that's it, you know.
Go park in the corner.
And just don't worry about any, you know, that's going to spread the floor and then we're going to have all of this space. And it's to a degree of, you know, we're not utilizing you know, the advantages that we're going to see in this game. Like, look, you know, the Jazz tried to get cute in their game against Denver, you know, and tried to put Bogdanovic on Jokic, and he punished them early and often in that game, and it backfired, you know. So there's an element to it where, and Jokic is a special breed, so it's hard to kind of really flag that. But the idea though is you got to punish the mismatch, and you got to see what it's there, and if your guy has to be able to do that. So it's not like you have to adjust. You have to be willing to say on the fly, okay, oh, you're going to put a 6'5 guy on a 7-footer. Cool. Go park it in the block now. Don't park it at the corner. Go park it in the block.
Well, to me, exactly. So to me, that's an excuse to involve my big in the game more. Now, typically for bigs, it's one of your more unskilled players, let's say. But when you have a guy who does have skill, like Brooke Lopez, or Giannis, which they never would guard Giannis with, you know, with a really small wing. He's too dangerous for that. But, you know, you do have Brooke Lopez, who is a skilled post player, a decent enough passer, and a threat to shoot the ball. Why not just get him involved in the action? Spotting up in the corner is not great. Like, the wide open corner threes typically come from relocation. A guy, you know, pushing down from the wing to the corner on a hammer or something like that. And so just standing there, you're not really affecting the geometry of the court all that much. Whereas you could get them in a pick and roll and or try to get them a good post-up look. Do something instead of just standing there.
No, I think that's right. I lost my train of thought.
Well, then
The point you made there is like the corner three is like the most replaceable offensive skill in NBA basketball right now. Like the number of guys who are on the court who can't be at least competent at that. So if that's like your offensive skill, sort of, so what? You're kind of a passenger, and you're not really you're stressing the defense insofar as it's hard for them to bring help to other things. You yourself are not causing a problem. So and you're wasting what a big man can bring if you just
and you're wasting him as a stretch big man, because you know the real thing that made the stretch big man so special was the pick and pop, right? That's where it put defenses in a difficult position, because now you got a guard, you know, especially if you have a dynamic guard who can attack off the pick and roll. Now you have to spend time there and then rotate out, you know, to the popping big. Like, this was a thing in San Antonio versus Dirk Nowitzki. Like, the amount of time we've spent in playoff series, I was in one playoff series against Dallas when I was in San Antonio, and the amount of time we spent on just how do we cover Dirk's pick and pops is the challenge. Like, that's the special thing of the shooting big, more than just he can shoot a three. It's that it really will screw up our entire defense when he does pick and pops. And I think that's where I think teams are failing, in the sense of like, we're just going to put our big spaced out there. Like, you tell me, Dave, I don't know how much pick and pop there's been between Doncic and Porzingis. Sometimes it just feels like Porzingis is parked on the wing. You're not utilizing it to the best of your ability, where it would open up opportunities for Luka to go. And I think that's kind of the thing that teams are missing these days, or have forgotten.
Yeah, there's a fair amount, but it's a lot of Porzingis on the wing, right? Like, I mean, he likes the ball there, and that's a thing. But Porzingis, you have to treat him a little bit differently than a conventional big, because he's not really a conventional big. He's really a big wing with the way he plays. But you brought up the pick and pop and kind of teams kind of going away from that. How about the trail three? To me, that's the most useful big man three, you know, opportunity that you've got. And I feel like I just don't see enough teams doing that. You see Denver doing quite a bit. Philly does it. But, you know, that should be a staple. Brooke Lopez should be getting plenty of opportunities for trail threes.
That just requires on how often he's running down. When you're in transition and it's Giannis, the play is usually over by the time he gets to the.
But I just think that the idea of stretching the floor, it just seems like so often that the stretching part of this is left out of the equation. And the Trail 3 legitimately stretches the floor. You cause the defense now, okay, we've got to start thinking about this closer. We got to get higher because they're looking to get this shot. I mean, it's the same thing we watched Steph Curry do in the league. You got to guard him at 35 feet. Oh, crap, you got to guard him at 40 feet. We got to pick him up at half court.
It's interesting, like we're way deeper in the X and O's than I thought we were going to get to. But I prefer to use a big, like to rim run with the big. And then because the best thing about like a Trail 3 is attacking the closeout.
Right.
And so like Porzingis can actually, that's one thing that for a lot of guys we're talking about, Porzingis can actually do. Mm-hmm. But if it's Brook Lopez and you pump fake and go, it's like, yeah, but it might be a little lumbering. So maybe you this is something that Embiid has done really well a lot this year. Mm-hmm. Is like if he's not the one who gets the rebound, he is straight line to the front of the rim, bury his guy there, and then cause the defense to collapse, and then you get the kick out to a trail, and either you get a an open shot or Tobias Harris attacking from an advantage situation, getting a closeout. And I think that has a decent amount to do with why Tobias Harris is having a nice year so far.
Just yeah.
In like a micro example.
Seth, you wrote a great article that's up at The Athletic with John Hollinger on NBA front offices and the decision-making process. I recommend everybody go check that out. But it got us talking in our group chat because, that's how we make the show. And you brought up the fact that speed is a little bit of a kind of like a silent threat to not only front offices, but coaches. I mean, we know about players and, Mo, we talked about this before the show. We know about young players in particular, the speed of the game throws them off. James Wiseman can't catch a pass because he's constantly thinking about what's happening next. But it's interesting, Seth, to see that sort of thinking applied to front offices as well. Could you elaborate just a little bit before we talk about it?
Sure. And I think it goes for both front offices and coaches too, but a lot of the mistakes you see teams make, especially if a team kind of has a bad draft or does something silly in free agency. I've had friends who work for other teams admit the day after the draft, yeah, that one got away from us. It's like something sort of unexpected happened. You have to pivot. Suddenly you're making decisions you weren't expecting to make. And like you've got 3 minutes to decide and all of your best laid plans for how to figure out, is this a good move or not, are just gone. So that's sort of the just as the speed of the game, not knowing what to expect can cause a young player to screw up. If you're not totally prepared or something catches you off guard, it's especially in those two moments where it's things happen fast and you have to adjust the draft and free agency. Trade deadline happens at a kind of a more stately pace. So it you're less likely to.
Well, for the front office, at least.
But I think a lot of the mistakes come from, we just didn't have enough time to make the decision well.
Yeah, and it's funny because like when you mention it with the draft, it's a situation where you're looking and all of a sudden it's like, this dude's dropping? Like, why? What the hell? What's going on? He's a really good player. What do we not know? Why is he not dropping? And you have that kind of panic set in and everybody trying to figure out, no, screw it, we're going to draft him or whatnot. Or somebody's calling to trade the pick to go get him, and you're trying to figure all that stuff out. It is that unknown kind of when it throws that wrench in there. And you can kind of tell the teams that aren't prepared, because at the end of the day, you can't fully prepare, but you can understand that like this is not necessarily going to go according to plan.
Well, so I guess let's talk about that. What happens when your offseason plan doesn't work out? Look, when you've been saving up cap space and assets to sign, let's say a guy who might be playing for the Greek national team, and then he happens to re-sign with his existing team, now what? Now what do you do? All of a sudden, not only has this summer changed for you, but next summer's changed. So how many plans are you going into the offseason with as far as, from a front office perspective, Seth?
I mean, you kind of hope to go in with several broad scenarios and then hope to apply kind of the lessons, the kind of the ethic of the broad scenario to whatever happens. The part where I think teams get caught out is I think every team does some scenarioizing. That's not a word. Might as well be. Every team does that to some degree. I don't think – like sometimes you don't realize you get caught up in events and don't realize, okay, we were in plan A. Things are happening now that put us in plan C. But you're still operating under the assumptions of plan A. And so not knowing that you have to flip that switch. Okay, we're not going star hunting anymore. We're trying to find – you know, we're trying to stock up on as many like reasonably priced 3-and-D wings as we can. And we'll beat the market that way. Might be a pivot you might make. But if you don't realize and like, oh man, we're going to miss out and you're – then all of a sudden you're burning a hole in your pocket and you give a decent player $8 million extra a year just to come up with something.
Right.
And
you sign six centers.
Well, I'm gonna put it this way. If your front office and you're preparing for – you were preparing for what Giannis's free agency was going to look like, and you didn't have a backup plan and your reaction was after he signed going like, okay, what do we do now? You're already done. It's over because you need to have that.
And let's be honest.
You need to have that.
None of the teams that were trying to get him didn't have a plan. Well, right?
We won't know, but like, but you need to have that stuff. You need to, it's like Seth said, you need to kind of game plan for a million different scenarios. And, you know, and it's not always necessarily just the one scenario. It's a combination of scenario 2B and 57C. And this collided and things like that. But you need to be constantly having that plan where like, okay, what are we going to do if Giannis resigns? And this is stuff they've been planning. You know, hopefully these smart teams have been planning ahead of time and not just, all right, if Giannis resigns, how are we going to pivot or whatnot? Because now, you know, you look at the free agent class this year and it's like, it's not as thrilling and exciting, you know, as it was a year ago. So now you have to figure that stuff out. And it's all about the planning ahead. And it's one of those things I used to say this about plays and play calling with players. Like if a player wants to improvise something off the playbook in the on the fly, he has to know the playbook in and out first. You know, so that he can then improvise. Yeah. And I think that's kind of the thing for these good front offices are they have their plan, they have their playbooks, they're ready to roll, and then they're ready to call the audible when they have to.
Yeah, there's a saying in photography that you have to know the rules before you can start to break them. I think it applies just about to anything. Music. Oh, there you go. It applies to anything. Yeah.
I applied it to basketball, so mine works.
There you go. So it's funny that the analytics guy says, oh, you know, the draft and free agency is the worst. And before we started the show, Mo was like, oh, I've got to talk about the lead up to the trade deadline. Because like, again, speed can kill. And so part of like people just don't see this part of the process. But Mo, what happens in the month heading into the trade deadline as far as the video room goes? Because you're not only running all of your regular day-to-day stuff for the team that's currently playing basketball games, but you're also putting together stuff for the front office, right?
Yeah, trade deadline really in the video room, at least in my experiences, we rarely had anything that was like urgent at the last second. You know, I think from that point, we've been pretty much covered. And most of the time, there wasn't much action in the video room on during the season in terms of trade deadline. Off season's a different story, free agency and things like that, whole different deal. But the idea of, you know, teams again are planning ahead of time for the trade deadline. These guys might be available. There are teams I know that the front office goes on a retreat almost a month before the deadline and start to have meetings and start sharing the intel. You know, because that's the most important thing, you know. I've been talking to so-and-so and they're not so happy with player X. You know, he didn't pan out the way they thought he would or whatnot or things like that. You know, like we might be able to get him or whatnot and things like that. So you start pulling all your intel together and start formulating a plan. Because the thing about the trade deadline is you're not the only one calling that team, you know, and it's a pace in which like you don't have the control of the pace in the sense of it is like, you might be like on like, oh, we're about to make our final offer. No, we pulled the trigger already. You're like, damn, we're screwed. It's the early preparation of all of this that I think is really interesting. And I think, again, the smart front offices are preparing for trade deadline right now for the one that's coming up in March.
Well, I was just about to ask Seth, you know, Seth, at what point were you prepping for the trade deadline? I mean, was this something like as soon as everyone was back from vacation, you know, early September, that you're already looking ahead to people who might potentially be available?
I think, I mean, you're maybe looking at that, but I think that you don't want to, you know, get some preconceived notions about a trade before you know what your team is. Mm-hmm. Like you might know going into the season that you probably have some need areas, but you don't really know. So I think there's a little bit of a wait and see for the first, you know, for the first couple of weeks of a season. It's also just kind of making sure all your stuff works. You know, all of your automated reports and whatnot are operating as they're supposed to. Okay, that's good. Kind of get a sense of where our team is, not just like internally, but relative to everyone else. If you're a team that's at like kind of a contending level, you also kind of start one eye looking towards, all right, what do we do if we play, like, what do we need if we play Philly? What do we need if we play Boston? What do we need if we play Brooklyn? Are we, you know, which of those teams from a matchup standpoint do we have the most problems and how can we address that? So you do want to take a little bit of time to figure out what the questions are as much as anything else, because like these trades aren't happening in a vacuum. They're all relative to, you know, what you need. And, you know, things can happen that, you know, injuries can happen. Young players can develop in ways that sort of change your time horizon. So you just need to give it a little bit of time for that to start. I want to piggyback on what Mo was saying. There is the worst thing that can happen is you forget that the other guy gets a turn. And that, you know, everyone makes these best laid plans. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to do the other thing. And you're making all those step-by-step detailed plans and you're forgetting 29 other people, really more. I mean, 29 other teams, yeah. Agents, media entities, like everyone is doing their own things that change the environment.
Yeah. And then Jeremy Grant signs with the Detroit Pistons, right? Like out of nowhere. So now
before they had the ability to sign him, it appeared.
Yeah. Well, that's a whole other story.
That's the Tuesday show. We have a
whole podcast named after it. You know, I forgot what I was going to say. Damn it. Happens sometimes. Run off the rails and then you forget what you're going to say. And now I'm trying to figure it. I'm stalling to see if it'll come back and it doesn't seem to be happening. Keep it in the show, Jade. Kind of pivot. Oh, I got it. Okay. So the other thing that the tweet that brought up the article, Seth, about siloing your two scouting departments and things like that. And you're right. It creates a very adversarial situation. But I do think front offices would be served to almost have one or two guys as like a red team or a consultant, you know, that you go, they're not involved in the discussions. They're not involved in everything, the lead up to stuff. And, you know, you just run it by them and go, hey, what do you think of this? Like, we're thinking of moving player X for player Y. This is our reasoning. This is, you know, our thoughts behind it. Like, what's your feel? Are we giving too much? Are we not giving up? Are we getting a steal? Are we valuing the wrong things? Like, I almost think there is a value to it, but I think it's just got to be like one dude, almost completely a consultant away from the franchise on a daily basis. But somebody, you know, who's watching games and understands that they're connected to the sport. I think there's something to that. The
vice
idea.
President of no.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know, I mean, like, yeah, you have, the media does it. Investigative journalists silo some of their own people to shoot holes in some of these investigative journalist projects and to make sure it's all covered and they're all nailed, you know? So I kind of think teams would benefit more from a consultant in that sense, instead of just siloing off the groups.
Yeah. I like collaboration. So I think that, you know, I like that idea though, Mo, maybe having an outside consultant, or just this podcast, just guys, you know, if you listen to
this, they can't afford NBA me, Dave. Executive. They can't afford me, Dave. Don't sell me out for just, cheap.
Before you make a move, just ask yourself, am I going to get roasted on Nerder for making this move? Look, one other place, guys, that speed kills is coaching. And we know these coaches that are ready for the big moments, and we know the ones that haven't been. End of game situations tend to really highlight the guys who, you know, are seeing the game in slow motion and the guys who aren't seeing anything because it's all a blur. And this season in particular, with the lack of practice time, it seems like chemistry is being built on the court. I think this is why you see some of these big minute load games from teams like Brooklyn. They're trying to build chemistry on the fly because they don't have practices. How do you guys feel about what we're seeing from some of the newer coaches this year? Because I think it's been hit or miss.
Is this the part where I talk about Minnesota's end game on Wednesday?
I thought that was pretty clear.
So you know, Minnesota is playing short on talent right now, and their offense down the stretch turned into a lot of like ugly D'Angelo Russell barfed up jumpers, which, you know, you're at a talent deficit. Sometimes that happens, and that's sort of whatever. I kind of wanted to focus on the situation. DeMar DeRozan, they're down two. DeMar DeRozan hits one of two at the free throw line with 17 seconds left. Minnesota has two timeouts left. Somehow, from a situation inbounding down three with two timeouts, they managed to get one shot with a terrible contested three with 3 seconds left. And that's the only look they get to attempt to close the gap or tie the game. And it's just that is to me the essence of the moment overtaking kind of the higher faculties to be able to figure out, like, if there's no way you should lose that game only getting one look at the basket with two timeouts left. And it was just viscerally frustrating for me to watch.
Are you struggling to close deals? B2B selling is tougher than ever. And that's why I want to tell you about LinkedIn Sales Navigator. LinkedIn Sales Navigator is a sales intelligence platform that helps professionals effectively prospect and engage high-value customers, drive higher revenue, and increase sales performance. Sales Navigator helps you target the right buyers, surface key signals, and show you hidden allies so that you can find those buyers that are most likely to convert. Fueled by LinkedIn's 1 billion member platform, Sales Navigator gives you up-to-date first-party data, enabling you to unlock conversations with the people that matter. Right now, you can try LinkedIn Sales Navigator and get a 60-day free trial at linkedin.com/NBAshow23. That's linkedin.com/NBAshow23 for a 60-day free trial. Let LinkedIn Sales Navigator help you sell like a superstar today. Just go to linkedin.com/NBAshow23 and get started.
Now, Mo, how much of this can we put on put at the feet of the coaching staff versus the players? It's got to be more on players than coaches, but coaches have to put these guys in a position to succeed.
Yeah, you took the words kind of right out of my mouth, Dave. Like, I get frustrated with coaches that are walking out of games with, you know, still having timeouts left, you know, at the end of a close game or in a situation like Seth just said, you had two timeouts and you only got one shot out of it. Like, you have to be smarter in how you plan things. And it's not just necessarily even Minnesota. Like, take case in point, the Celtics Kings game from the other night, you know, that went down to the wire. You know, the Celtics are down three. They're going to run a play. And I had two problems with the play that Brad Stevens ran. One, he made it too easy for them to foul somebody that's inside a two. You know, the play, you know, it was their play where they throw it to the other side of the court and then run somebody off of a screen to set up the three. Well, one, they threw it to Grant Williams, who's shooting 59% from the free throw line. So bad free throw shooter. Second, you know, he's inside the 3-point line. So the Kings smartly fouled, you know, and that was Tyrese Haliburton, making a smart play there and fouling. Now you have your worst free throw shooter.
Seems so unlike him.
And you, you have your worst free throw shooter going to the line now, and now you need to be, smart with how you do it. He misses the first free throw. He misses the second free throw on purpose and executes it really well to get the ball to Tatum, and they had a chance to tie it. But when I saw the play, I was like, what is Brad Stevens doing? Like, that's just a bad play call at the end of games. And I think sometimes, it happens so quickly. I don't think people understand it, even as a coach. Sometimes you're just sitting there and you're just like, oh, crap. Or we had a foul to give. I didn't know. Or how much information are they getting quickly enough in terms of making their decision and thinking quickly? It's hard. In the final 2 minutes of a game, end of game coaching can be really difficult. And even the veteran coaches have a brain fart from time to time.
I mean, look, the best coaches really wind up having some of the best players too. And so it's hard to judge. How do you judge the Miami Heat in crunch time when they have Jimmy Butler, who has been one of the best crunch time players in the league?
Yeah, in that specific situation, you have so much control as a coach of like time and space because of those two timeouts. The part that frustrates me kind of about this is so much of coaching is, as much as I'm kind of quote unquote the numbers guy, I recognize that so much of coaching is a little bit of feel. It's the analogy I've used. I think I've used it here before, is a lot of in-game decision making is cooking. It's a pinch of this, a dash of that. Give it a taste. See what we feel like. End of game situations are baking. It's a recipe. And the biggest way you can avoid yourself getting, caught up in the moment at the end of a game is to have already made the decision. And I think that this might be something that I think Quinn Snyder does this. I'm not sure how many other coaches do, where they spend a lot of time. Okay, we're on the plane. We're shooting the shit. We're playing cards. Okay, we're done playing cards. Okay, quick pop quiz. 10 seconds left. We're down one, blah, blah, blah. What do you do? And so you game these scenarios out, and then you make those decisions, you talk it out, you make those decisions, and then that comes up in the game. And maybe there's someone on the bench who's like, hey, this is where we run X because we already decided it. And it seems like that's really a way that, it's probably something that we focus on too much because it's visible and really, the way, like if you're in one of these situations, you've probably sort of already lost the game, but still you're trying to, margins matter, especially in a playoff situation. If you can go from like a 5 to a 10% chance of stealing a playoff game, that's how much is that worth? So
millions.
Again, that goes back to the preparation. Yeah. Right.
Right. And sometimes it's also on the players. Like when you look at the Mavs loss to the Suns, they made the players a no. They were aware that they had a foul to give. So when Chris Paul is sitting there and Maxi Kleber's on him and he's sitting there waiting for Devin Booker to come off those screens, Kleber needs to foul there. He needs to know and recognize that that's a situation. Right. Foul. Let's get them to have to, and I think the Suns were out of timeouts at that point. Now let's see them call a play on the fly with even less time. Some of that is, the coaching does their job, but the player doesn't execute it. And some of that's something you got to drill and practice. And it's a back to Seth thing too of, gaming these things out and having these discussions and having that. It goes back to the broader point we've had all show, right? Planning ahead and being prepared. The more plans you make and the more you're prepared for these things, the more you'll be able to handle it when the time comes. And even if you have to call an audible. So I think that's part of this whole thing in the end of game scenarios. And, every team I've been a part of, tons of practice, just ends of game stuff, get in plays, need plays. We need a two, we need a three, so on and all of these things. So, I think there's an important element to this whole thing. It's almost like playing war games. You kind of have to do this to get the guys ready. Maybe it's more difficult this year with the pandemic, but.
Well, that's a good point. I think that this year, the bad examples are going to stand out even more because teams aren't able to really work on this stuff. This is another instance of continuity really is going to help a bunch of teams. I mean, Utah has so many guys that have just been there that I feel like that has helped them quite a bit in this early run that they've had. And you know, they look so far ahead of everyone else. Same with the Lakers and the Clippers. You know, that continuity, especially for your major players, I think is vitally important. Well, guys, as we wrap up, we're going to do like we do almost every week. And Mo, what are you looking at for the next
one? I don't know if I'm looking at one thing in particular, but I'm just going to continue railing against the Euro foul that stops the transition baskets. You know, that stops the fast break. The NBA has got to get rid of this. This is becoming...
It's un-American.
No, forget about it. It's bad for the product.
It's not fun.
Bad for the product. We're eliminating, we're taking fast breaks are a fun part of basketball, and we're taking it out of the game with a foul, and then it needs to go be reviewed to make sure it was a clear path foul. Like, you know, and my answer, and it's extreme, and I get it, and shouldn't shock anybody, I go a little bit nuts here, but man, make it three free throws in the ball. Make teams really have to pay for breaking up the transition stuff. And it's not even about the game. It's about just ruining the product. Go defend. Let's quit with this. Oh no, we're outnumbered. Foul. Like, no, play freaking defense.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, why would you want fewer of the most exciting play on television in basketball? You know, it never made sense to me. Seth, what about you? What are you looking at?
Since I'm way down the shot quality rabbit hole, the second part of my series of that drop today at The Athletic, I was sort of examining the levers of different aspects of shot quality. There's kind of two opposite things going on right now that are kind of almost inconsistent and seem really weird. One is the Knicks continue to be the Obi-Wan Kenobi of open shot defense, where it doesn't matter who it could be Seth Curry, Kyle Korver, and JJ Redick in his prime lined up on the arc. They're just not making shots with the Knicks with all five guys in the paint. And I'm just, you know, is this real? Are they doing something, or are they going to get slapped in the face?
Tom Thibodeau. Yeah, he's yelling ice. Yeah, and other things.
and because there's fewer fans, you can hear the ice. And it's like, man, his voice sounds bad. And that's distracting. Maybe that's a theory.
I'll yeah. It.
On the flip side, this year is in, you know, since 2013-14, the first year we have the data to look at kind of contested, uncontested. This year is by far the highest the league collectively has shot on uncontested threes. And it's the average year in, year out is 38.5, somewhere in there. This year it's 39.6. And it's not like there's better shooters are getting more shots this year. It's the same kind of averagey guys who you'd expect to shoot around 38.5 is shooting. It may not sound like a big difference, but across the normal variation of seasons, that's enormous. And just wondering what's going on with that and how that is going to continue to affect, like, teams that have been playing kind of casino style will be the house and win on small margins kind of defenses over over the course of the season. So those are maybe I'm way down the nerd rabbit hole, but this is Nerder and that's what I'm looking at.
Well, that's what it's for. You know, I'll point you in the direction of some of the data that we looked at with the extra space on the sidelines. And I wonder how much of a difference that's making, not to mention the backdrops. I mean, some of the backdrops that you've seen in the arenas are just absolutely fantastic for shooting. Maybe not as good as the bubble was, but still pretty good. Those, especially the teams that are doing the blue tarps, I feel like those are really helping people. Well, for me, it's funny that Seth brought up the shot quality because I've been looking at what the heck is happening with the Dallas Mavericks. They are not this bad of a team, but they are one of the worst catch and shoot teams in the league. They're generating looks. They just cannot make shots. And as we know, it is a make or miss league. And they are just missing so much that this team looks like it has no hope in the postseason. So I'm assuming they're going to regress to the mean. But when you look at the guys that are missing, I think that they just need some shooters. So paying really, really extra close attention to Dallas this week because it's getting late already.
Add Miami to that.
That's going to do it for this week, folks. Oh, yeah. Well, it's been late for Miami because the East, the top of the East is really tough. Anyway, it's a surprisingly competitive season. And so some of these surprises are really catching me off guard. That's going to do it for this week, folks. We'll be back again next week to do this all over again. For Seth, for Mo, I'm Dave. You guys take it easy.